Good day, listeners. This is your host, Michael Martins, with the Martins Critical Review, broadcasting this afternoon after digging out from an overnight snowstorm here in south-central British Columbia. In today's episode, we continue our investigative series into the actual science behind the Earth's ever-changing climate, continue to provide evidence to counter the bogus mainstream narrative, and examine the threat that renewable and unreliable energy sources pose to Western nations. Joining us today is Professor Ian Plimmer, Australia's best-known and most-loved geologist. Professor Plimmer has published more than 120 scientific papers on geology and was one of three editors of the five-volume Encyclopedia of Geology. With his most recent publication of the book Green Murder, he has now published 11 books written for the general public, and he frequently publishes newspaper and magazine opinion pieces, as well as academic book chapters. His latest book has been a labor of love and hate, unfunded by third parties. It is important to note that he has never been funded or employed by the fossil fuel or uranium industries. The recipient of numerous awards and multiple accolades, Professor Plimmer has been an outspoken critic of both creationism and the supposed scientific consensus on anthropogenic climate change. It is also important to note that Professor Plimmer has spent much of his life in the rough and tumble of the zinc-lead-silver mining town of Broken Hill, where an interdisciplinary scientific knowledge base intertwined with a healthy dose of skepticism and pragmatism are necessary for survival. He has worked for North Broken Hill Limited, was a consultant to many major mining companies, and has been a director of numerous exploration public companies listed in London, Toronto, and Sydney. His post-university career, he is proudly a director of a number of various unlisted private Hancock prospecting companies. Professor Plimmer, it is a privilege to be able to speak with you today. Thank you so much for your time and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Excellent, sir. So perhaps we begin today on a bit more of a personal note, and if you could give listeners a bit of a background and an idea who the young Ian Plimmer was and what motivated that young man to pursue the field of geology.
As a child, I was always wandering through the bush collecting rocks. I loved to collect small pieces of shale with fossils in them. I was in a major basin, a Sydney basin, where there were some fossils in the shales, and in the sandstones there was really nothing to find. And I used to take these dreadful broken up bits of plant fossils into the Australian Museum in the centre of Sydney, and the curator would spend a lot of time with me explaining how these told us about the past and how interesting they were, and how it really encouraged me. And little was he to know, and little was I to know, that 20 years later we were going to be publishing science together. And so it's quite ironical. And I got a lot of encouragement at school. I once asked my chemistry teacher at school, well, how do they make copper wire? Where does it come from? How do you get copper? And he was so busy, he told me, he couldn't talk to me just then, but he'll see me in the morning. And I now know that he didn't have a clue, but he was going to spend the night looking it up. And he explained to me that you find these rocks with shiny minerals in them, you crush them and you grind them and you float off copper minerals, and then you smelt them and oxidize them, and then you dissolve them and precipitate copper, and then the molten copper you draw out into wire. And I just thought that was fabulous, because I was using copper wire then in my crystal set. We didn't have radios, we didn't have transistors, we didn't have television, and I had a little crystal set that I strung up an aerial of copper wire on the roof and wound my own coils. So I got very interested in the basics. How do we get simple commodities? And I was interested in where they come from, how we get them out of the ground. And for a person of my age, a childhood was a very simple childhood. We left the house early morning and we came back at dark, and we spent our time looking after ourselves. We had no television, we had no radio, we had no push bikes. We had to do everything on foot. And we had a very creative time being out in the bush and making things and building things. And it was a great childhood. In fact, it was the best one I ever had. And that was a very different childhood to kids now, who are trapped indoors looking at a screen, who don't go outside, who don't break bones, who don't cut themselves, who don't fall out of trees. And that is very much the driving force behind my inquisitiveness, my interest in the planet and how we use materials from the planet to make things that we use every day.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, your childhood sounds very much like mine, and I do share your opinion that, God help us with all these children that are living in concrete jungles staring at screens. I mean, they're completely removed from the real essence of the planet.
Yes, that's very much so. And they haven't experienced things. And you've got to experience pain. You've got to fall out of trees. You've got to fall into a river. You've got to build a tree house that falls down. You've got to have these experiments that fail, because most of everything you do in life is a failure. You live on your successes. You dine out on your successes. But most of the time, you do something, it doesn't work. Occasionally in sport, you might be in a winning team, but most of the time, you're not. And it's very important to play in these teams. It's very important to share the pain with the team. So, in today's world, I fear that we have an education system that's weak. We have a social system that doesn't train young people to have hardship and get on with life after hardship. Almost everything we do doesn't work. I'm quite comfortable with that. This is what a very frugal background, and we were in post-war times. It was very frugal. All the neighbors helped each other. My father was an invalid. He didn't work. My mother had to struggle dreadfully to keep us fed and alive, and we were the first generation that ever went to university. And these were times of struggle. These were times of very frugal life. These were times when everyone chipped in together and helped each other. And I think they were the glory times. I think I've probably lived as a human in the very, very best times to be a human on planet Earth.
Interesting, interesting. And then when did you become an outspoken critic then of the mainstream climate alarmist narrative? And was there an aha moment that predicated this move?
Well, I've always been, as some people call me, a troublemaker. I've always questioned some fundamentals, and I thought you were going to ask me this question. So I was thinking about the first time that I ever remembered going against the popular way of thinking. And it was when I was about 13 at a church camp, and I had a young lady who was interested in me, and she asked me, "Do I believe in love at first sight?" And I said, "No," and attempted to explain my reasons to her, and by then she'd lost interest in me totally. And I realized then that there is a price for speaking the truth, and there is a price for trying to use logic and common sense. And through my university years, I was too busy working hard. Through my PhD research, I was too busy working hard. And then when I started to work underground, deep in the mines, I met people there who had no education. These were people who were extremely good thinkers. And these were people who, even though they had no education, had a huge amount of knowledge. And I had some very, very sobering lessons with miners telling me not to go there because it was dangerous. And I didn't realize it was dangerous. I had a very sobering lesson from a miner underground who brought me a very, very unusual mineral. I didn't know what it was. And he said, "Well, you're a rock doctor. What's this?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." I could have given him some name and he would have said, "Oh, yes," and wandered off. And But I said, "Look, if you give me this specimen overnight, I can X-ray it and I can tell you what it is. But I'll have to take a bit the size of a pinhead to X-ray it." And he said, "Oh, yes, no problems." And so I took this away. And in those times, it took about 6 hours to get an X-ray. Now it takes a few minutes. And I hit it with X-rays. I had a film trace that I had to measure the shrinkage and measure the X-ray lines. And I worked out what the mineral was. And it was a mineral I'd never ever heard of. It was a mineral called parsettansite. And so I went back underground the next day and found him somewhere and gave him back his specimen and said, "Well, look, here's the X-ray trace, and I've calculated that this mineral is parsettansite." He said, "Oh, is it the iron-rich parsettansite or the manganese-rich parsettansite?" And all of a sudden, I realised I might have academic qualifications, but I know nothing. And that was a great lesson that I learned about a kilometre underground at Broken Hill. And these people are rough and ready people. They often are highly educated. I had one chap who comes to my Broken Hill house. He reads my library. He's currently reading a whole lot of the French classics by Emile Zola. Now, he's a bloke who's a raised bore miner. These are people who put holes going upwards for ventilation. There's stuff falling on them all the time. And he's reading Emile Zola. So I have a great respect for the average person out there through many reasons might not have had an education, but it doesn't mean that they're not intelligent. It doesn't mean they don't have knowledge. And these people were also very sceptical. They were also very sceptical of people like me. Here I was, they called me a rock doctor, and they were testing me with this very unusual mineral. Now, I said, I don't know. But if I'd said, oh, it's so-and-so, they would have said, oh, yeah, righto. And then the whole mine would have learnt that this bloke is full of hot air. Don't believe him. And so I learnt very early on that the average person has a filter that they can detect codswallop very, very easily. So that was a great lesson. And I kept growing from that throughout life. Part of my life as a scientist has always been to ask questions. We don't use the word believe in science because belief is a word of religion and politics. It's not a word of science. I don't have an opinion. I have facts. And those facts are underpinned by evidence. And so almost everything I look at in today's world, I underpin with the question, well, can you please show me the evidence? And in very large number of cases, people have no evidence. They go on what is a fad or a fashion. And these fools then continue, and eventually these things can lead to financial disasters and frauds. So my education, my training has been such that I am really not the sort of person to have at a dinner party. I ask questions and I ask people to justify their statement. Now, that is not being an ungrateful guest. That is just the way my brain operates.
Yes, yes. Well, I think we need a few more people out there that are operating in that fashion. We'd be in a lot less trouble. So would you agree then that a strong measure of scientific competency resides in the ability of that science to accurately predict or model future trends within that system that it claims to study and understand?
Well, that's a good question. Now, science is underpinned by evidence. And that evidence is from measurement, it is from experiment, and it's from observation. And we do that time and time and time and time again, until we have repeatability. And then we can come up with a conclusion that there might be a certain natural process that has given us that evidence. Now, with more evidence or with recalculation, we can change our conclusion. Now, what this means is that there are many scientific processes that we don't really understand well enough. So we attempt to model them. And to model them, we have to use unknown unknowns. And in most cases, models don't work. For example, in my discipline, in mineral exploration, we create geophysical models combined with a geological and geochemical model. And we test these models with a rotary lie detector. And this is called a diamond drill. And you collect core, and invariably, you find that these models are not correct. You don't throw out the model. You try to refine it. And you might put in a second hole and still fail. And after the third hole, the management might say, well, you've had your fun, you've spent the money, goodbye, we walk away. So in science, we try to understand with models, and science is not in the business of prediction. And models try to explain how a phenomenon works, but many people use models to make a prediction. So we've seen these in the area of climate studies, where there have been models done over the last 30 years predicting what the temperature is going to be. Now, we've been able to compare these with actual measurements over the last 30 years, and the models overcook. The models don't work. So there are some fundamental parameters that must be wrong in those models. Now, I think I know what those parameters are, but we find that all the time in my area, in mineral exploration especially, where you are testing models, and most of the time you fail. Well, you have to get used to failure.
Yes. So could you assign a letter grade then, or a score regarding the historic record of mainstream climate alarmists' predictions and modeling when it comes, or as compared to the real and actual evidence?
Am I allowed to use minus numbers or only positive numbers?
Well, whatever you like, sir. You're the professor.
Well, I'll go into the minus numbers. I think they've been appalling, and I think there have been major political decisions based on models which are unfounded, and these major political decisions are costing the average person a fortune. For the elites, for the wealthy, it doesn't cost them, but for the average person, these models have been such a disaster, and the policy derived from those models that it is costing a lot of people a lot of money. And this is especially so in countries that have embraced renewable energy, or what I call renewable energy. Their economies are now in a serious state. And an example would be, say, Germany or England.
Yes. So we can, I guess, agree then that the climate alarmists have a negative credibility and that their core competency is simply the promulgation of propaganda and the fabrication of a false alarm.
Well, yes, I think that's a wonderful weapon to use because we humans are hardwired to be frightened. We're frightened of the bear that might be coming up behind us. We're frightened of the dark. We whistle in the dark. We're frightened of things we can't see, like an invisible gas that we can't smell called carbon dioxide. We're frightened of things we can't see, like radiation. We're frightened of things we can't see, like viruses and bacteria. So we are hardwired to deal with fear. And if you can exploit that hardwiring, if you can exploit that fear, then you have a wonderful political tool. Now, if you use a model based on mathematics, and very few people can add up and subtract and multiply, let alone use more complex mathematics, then you have a wonderful tool to frighten people. And you can show them a simple graph with a lion going northwards, and we're all going to be doomed, and we've got to change our ways. So that's been exploited, and it's been exploited to the absolute maximum. Politicians who are generally fairly ignorant have fallen into the trap, and journalists, of course, journalists have got the are basically scientifically illiterate. The journalists would have the scientific literacy equivalent to someone who can't read or write, so they're not able to ask a simple scientific question. They're not able to dissect the science. They're not able to understand the simple assumptions that go behind making a model upon which the predictions are made, upon which a policy is built. So we've put ourselves into a very backward situation by ignoring the basics of logic and the basics of the scientific method, which has taken us 2,500 years to create. And we're ignoring all of that. Even some of the arguments put up now would be destroyed by the ancient Greeks 2,500 years ago because they used something which is so rarely used today, and that's called logic.
Yeah, it sure seems that. And I've said through this whole pandemic that we're not really suffering from a pandemic of an unknown intruder, but it's a pandemic of a lack of math, science, and history education. And the your comments on the journalists and politicians are absolutely on point. We seem to have this class of people that are all engaged in propaganda instead of actually dissecting information and reporting it or implementing real evidence into a policy.
Well, that's quite right, but in today's world, you need not watch or listen to mainstream media. You can search and go to blog sites. You can go to presentations like yours. You can find all sorts of things. So there are people out there who may or may not be journalists giving a contrary view. They are out there. It's just a matter of looking for it. Now, if you want to settle down in front of the television every night and watch one of the mainstream stations, then you are going to get a form of propaganda that dulls your brain. If you want to have your brain a little bit sharper, go and search for it. Now, quite often you need to know the questions to ask, but the information is out there. And in today's world, we do have a diversity of opinion despite cancellation by YouTube and despite cancellation by all sorts of social media networks. You can actually find the information that you might need to critically evaluate. Now, it is information. I didn't say it was knowledge, because a lot of information out there is just propaganda. A lot of information comes from people who are a little bit unbalanced. So we have a world of information out there. We have to spend a lot more time now dissecting it because we cannot trust the media at all.
Yes, agreed. I've heard you mention that science advances one funeral at a time, and this was certainly the case with another great geological premise advanced by J. Harlan Bretz. As you know, may know, Bretz received the Penrose Medal at the age of 96, and to which he remarked, "All of my enemies are dead, so I've no one to gloat over." Do you think we're going to see a similar situation unfold within climate science?
Oh, very much so. I think what will drive the end of it will be money. Ultimately, this is going to cost us too much. Ultimately, the average person is going to say, no, I've made enough sacrifices for this climate panic. Let me start looking at some of the alternative thinking on this. And unfortunately, I think we need a financial disaster or perhaps even a war before people will realize that this has been an extremely expensive adventure into junk science, and it will take time. Now, these critics may or may not be alive when that happens, who knows? But I hope I'm around to be able to say, well, look, I told you so.
Very good. What's a liter of unleaded regular gasoline selling for in your area these days?
The Australian dollar is just a little bit weaker than the Canadian dollar. It's selling for about $1.70, $1.80 if you use the premium 98 octane, which I use in one of my cars.
And diesel?
Diesel's about $1.70.
Okay. It's about the same. Yeah, we're at presently here. We're at about $1.52 a liter, so a little bit cheaper, but not much.
Well, Canadian petroleum comes from its own sources. Canada has a lot of oil and gas. We have a huge amount of gas, most of which we export, and our oil fields are offshore. Most of that goes abroad, and our oil fields onshore and in the south of the country are getting towards the end of their life. We have a large number of basins that haven't been explored. But as a result of various environmental and greens policies over a long period of time, we have a huge amount of petroleum sitting in our basins, waiting, to be used. Now, we have a different problem to Canada, and that is that we have only a couple of refineries in Australia. Most of our petroleum products are refined in India and in Singapore and come on the seaways into Australia. Now, that puts us under a huge risk, because if those seaways are blocked, we don't have any diesel, and this country runs on diesel. Everything you can see, everything you use is delivered to you by diesel trucks. And unless you have diesel, you die. So we don't have a strategic storage of diesel. We do not have an indigenous supply of oil and gas that we can use. We export pretty well all of our gas. We're not exploring basins where we can find petroleum. And so we put ourselves, thank you to the Greens, we put ourselves in a very, very exposed position. And we're a little bit closer to China than you are. And that exposed position, I think, is of great concern in this country.
And certainly here in Canada, we have a similar issue where we do have a large petroleum reserve, but I believe we're at about maybe 25% of our refining capacity. So we pipeline to the United States, down to the Oklahoma, Texas area, and then pipeline back the finished product, which of course makes no sense. But that is again the Greens' policy of limiting refinery capacity, and I think also that those established refineries in the South are looking to maintain their market share as opposed to giving some up to an upstart in Canada. So there's some political as well as some economic issues going on there.
Well, you also have opposition to pipelines to the point where it's absolutely crazy. You bring down crude oil in diesel-driven locomotives into the US, and it gets refined in the US rather than using a pipeline. Now, you've gone the most inefficient route you can simply because of political pressure, and those who suffer the political fallout from that are those who can afford to.
That's right. That's right. So if we get back into the climate discussion, the history of the Earth isn't one of consistent conditions. There's been a tremendous swing, both in atmospheric concentrations as well as temperatures. Can you give us sort of a brief overview of that process over, let's say, the last few million years?
We've always had climate change on planet Earth. We have climate change on other planets and moons in our solar system. And there is evidence which comes from observations of white dwarfs from things like the Hubble telescope that there's perhaps climate change on exoplanets. And these are planets outside our solar system associated with other stars. So we have climate change in our solar system and elsewhere in the galaxy. On another scale, we have climate change on planet Earth, which is very much related to the pulling apart and stitching back together of continents. And those are on cycles of about 400 million years. At times, we have a bad galactic address. And that bad address is every 143 million years. And that creates a climate change. We also have orbital variations on about 100,000 years, about 40,000 years, and about 20,000 years, where we are closer to or further from the sun. And so we get cooler or warmer. And we also have changes in the sun. The sun isn't constant, it puts out various amounts of energy. And we have solar cycles, and these cycles are about every 10,000 years, 1,500 years, roughly 200 years, and 22 years. And we can measure these. And we can measure these directly, and we measure them from solar footprints that are left way back in time. We also have a lunar tidal node where we're pushing warm water into the Arctic every 18.6 years. And that then creates other cycles that we have on Earth, like a 60-year cycle in the oceans, which is a combination of solar events. And what that means is that on planet Earth, climate is always changing. You cannot conserve anything in an environment that's always changing. We are having climate change all the time. If we didn't have climate change, I would be seriously worried. In the history of our planet, we've had six major ice ages. And during those ice ages, we have had a glaciation and we've had an interglacial. Now, during the last glaciation, Canada was covered in ice. All of Canada was covered in ice. It came well down into the US. Further south in the US, there were strong winds giving L'Ouest, giving these wind-blown sands. We see the same in Mongolia. We see the same in inland Australia. So the last ice age was savage. We had Canada covered in kilometers of ice. We had Scandinavia covered in about 5 kilometers of ice. And since that ice has melted, the Scandinavia is rising. So that then raises the question about sea level measurements, which we'll come to later. So during the last glaciation, it was extreme. And we humans survived that. We lived around the edge of the ice sheets. We survived. And we were at the peak of that last glaciation some 20,000 years ago. And about 12,700 years ago, the ice started to break up. And we had in Canada a breakdown of a massive ice sheet. We flooded the oceans with very cold, fresh water. That gave us a short, sharp period of cooling, which we call the Younger Dryas. This was a 1,500-year period where we suddenly dropped into extraordinarily cold climates. And then we had a period of global warming afterwards. And we only rose about 15 degrees Celsius in about 10 years. And then we came back into a warm period. Then we came back into a short, sharp, cold period for about 500 years when Canada did the same thing, dropped great ice sheets into the Atlantic Ocean. And then we came into the maximum temperatures of our interglacial. And they were about 7,000 to 4,000 years ago. And since then, we've actually been cooling. Since then, sea level has dropped by about 1.5 meters. So during human times, we have seen massive changes in temperature and massive changes in the ice sheets. And we know that from history. We know we had a Minoan warming, then we had a cold period, then we had the Roman warming, then we had the cold period called the Dark Ages, then we had the medieval warming, where there was about 300 years of wonderfully warm weather. And in fact, this was so good for planet Earth that we had a population expansion. We had a couple of crops a year that the Europeans could grow. The excess money went into the great monasteries and churches and universities that started to be built. Then we came into the Little Ice Age, where it had ultra cold periods when there was a solar minimum. And we started to come out of that Little Ice Age about 170 years ago. And it's been warming over those last 170 years. Now, that raises all sorts of questions. If you want to say the planet has been warming, when do you start the measurements? If you start the measurements in the peak of the Little Ice Age, then of course the planet's been warming. If you start the measurements 8,000 years ago, then the planet's been cooling. If you start the measurements 200,000 years ago, the planet has cooled, it's warmed, it's cooled, and it's warmed. So you have to be very careful when people say the planet is warming or the planet is cooling, or we've had the hottest summer ever. In our current interglacial, we've had more than 9,000 periods of time when it's been hotter than now. So the whole business of saying that we are in the hottest summer ever is fraught with difficulties, and quite often these are totally ignored by the press because they can't ask the questions. They don't know what to ask.
Yes, yes. And of course, I was in Australia in 19 when you had those medium-sized fires that the world thought were extreme. And of course, if you look back historically, they were somewhere, you know, 10 times smaller than some of those larger fires that occurred in the 50s. As well, the loss of life was also much less significant. Not that any life lost is not significant, but we do need to look at the time span. And it seems like this younger generation has the attention span of a flea, and if something doesn't occur within 6 months or several years, beyond that time span, somehow it's not relevant.
Well, you're absolutely correct. Those 2019-2020 summer fires that we had in Australia were catastrophic, but they were certainly not the worst we've ever had. During the times of European civilization in Australia, we had far bigger fires in 1939, far bigger fires in 1851. We lost a far greater area of land. We've lost fewer buildings because there weren't that many buildings in. We don't know how many people died in 1851 because a lot of people lived out in the bushes, gold prospectors, living a very lonely, frugal life. We don't know how many people died then. In 1939, we had a considerable number of people die, but in some of our fires in the 1980s and 90s, we had far more people die than our 2019-2020 fires. But what's happened is that in this country, we had fire stick hunting, and the Aboriginal population used to burn off patches of the bush in wintertime. These were cold fire burns. They didn't burn off a big acreage, and this killed off the undergrowth. The grass could come back, and in the grass were the kangaroos, which they could hunt, and that was their food. And that was their method of hunting, as a grass stick burning out of the undergrowth. So we didn't have massive bushfires when the Aboriginal population was here. And the early explorers and early settlers in Australia noticed that there were myriads of fires all through Australia. There were many trees that were burnt, but they could travel through the forests because there was no undergrowth. And once farming started, then the Aboriginal population moved away from these areas, the undergrowth grew back, and now with the green movement, it is now not possible to be able to burn off large areas of the undergrowth with cold fires in wintertime when we're not going to have a catastrophic fire, when we're not going to destroy a lot of the wildlife. They can move. When you might be burning a few thousand acres, they can move to somewhere else. And we've just had an accumulation of fuel over the last decades, and that fuel eventually becomes an incendiary bomb. Now, we've had about 30 inquiries over the last 150 years into bushfires and the deaths and property damage in bushfires. Every one of them has said you have to lower the fuel load. Yet we have our environmentalists and our green left people who are objecting to anything being done to the fuel load. So what happens is smaller fires become more catastrophic. We lose more property because more people are building houses in bushland where they can feel with nature. So the whole concept of these fires being unprecedented, which was a word used, or due to climate change, is just total rubbish. And all you need to do is to have a 30-second search on a mobile phone, and you will find with this cell phone search that these are not unprecedented. There have been much bigger fires in the past. And this is laziness on the consumer and the journalist side, where they just can't be bothered to check their facts.
Yes, and certainly we have a similar situation here, particularly in British Columbia, with increasing fires, which is directly related to the logging activities and the microclimate of lower humidity because of those clear cuts. And as you more of that landscape becomes clear cut versus forest matter, you're going to have an action which is localized drying. And when a fire does begin, it's going to rage through a larger area because it is drier. So I mean, we sort of have an opposite situation than you do, but these are not climate change related. These are human caused changes as opposed to, a CO2 or some other effect causing these changes.
Yes, well, that's the case here also. We have fires which are predictable, and that's based on the weather. If you have a wet winter and a couple of wet winters, then a long, dry, hot summer, you've got a fire waiting to happen. Now, those fires are not related to climate change because about 75% of them are lit by arsonists. So that cannot possibly be due to climate change.
That's right. That's right. So, in one of your lectures I found online, you speak about the mineral dolomite and the atmospheric conditions that must be present to create this substance. Can you share those details with us? Because I think this really gives an interesting picture of what the Earth has experienced in terms of its atmosphere over the time.
Well, the Earth's atmosphere has changed. We've had three atmospheres. The very early atmosphere was a non-breathable atmosphere of ammonia. It had methane, carbon dioxide, nitrogen, helium, and hydrogen, which were escaping from it. And it changed into a carbon dioxide-rich atmosphere. And then that has changed into an oxygen-rich atmosphere, which we now enjoy. And the oxygen-rich atmosphere has been with us for about 500 million years. When we had a carbon dioxide-rich atmosphere, we precipitated minerals which tell us that the atmosphere was very rich in carbon dioxide. Now, the mineral dolomite is a calcium magnesium carbonate. Some of you gardeners would use it to condition the soil. And dolomite is an interesting mineral because you can make it in the laboratory. And if you make dolomite in the laboratory, you need a very large concentration of carbon dioxide. You virtually need to have dolomite to be able to be precipitated naturally from seawater. You need to have an atmosphere that has percent carbon dioxide in it, whereas now we have about 400 parts per million carbon dioxide or 0.04%. So once you see the rock dolomite that's bedded, that's layered, that's got fossils in it, that's been precipitated from seawater, you can conclude using this experimental work that the atmosphere must have had percent carbon dioxide in it. So you think, well, if you've got percent carbon dioxide using the popular paradigm, we should have had runaway global warming. And we can see periods of time when the planet was warm. You see it with the vegetation, you see it with the rainfall, you see it with the amount of sedimentation, but you don't see that. In these massive sequences, which you get in northern Canada, which you get in, say, Namibia, Australia, US, Argentina, you see that there are two great ice age events that occurred at times when we had dolomite being precipitated. In fact, the debris left behind by retreating ice is covered in a number of places by dolomite, showing that we went from temperatures of about minus 40 to temperatures of about plus 40. Now, that's showing us, it's written in stone, that there is no way that carbon dioxide drives global warming. What we see is a high carbon dioxide atmosphere in the past, wherein we've had the greatest ice ages this planet has ever experienced. And associated with those ice ages, one of them was in the Cryogenian. What associated with one of those ice ages about 600 to 700 million years ago, there were multiple glaciations and multiple interglacials, and we just had a slight change in sea level, only 600 meters. So at those times, we had no continental shelf. We only had the ocean deeps and the land covered in ice, or we had a very high sea level and a huge continental shelf. So looking back in the past, we can see evidence of climate written in stone, and we can see that the popular paradigm that atmospheric carbon dioxide drives global warming could not be true, and the mineral dolomite is the key to this.
And so when you speak of percentage levels, I mean, are we talking 2-3% or what is your estimation there?
The scientific literature gives us figures from about 4% up to as high as 20%. Now, we have to remember that the current atmosphere's got 0.04% carbon dioxide in it, and we're talking about 4% to 20%. Now, we can calculate that because what we do is we go to areas where the rock dolomite is precipitated, we measure the thickness of the dolomite sequence, we measure the length of the dolomite sequence, and we assume that it maybe goes to 1 kilometre in depth. We can then calculate the amount, the tonnage of dolomite that we have there. And dolomite, we know chemically, has got 48% carbon dioxide in it as a gas. And then we can work out, well, that carbon dioxide must have come from the atmosphere. We put it back into the atmosphere, and we can say, oh, the atmosphere must have had 4 to 20% carbon dioxide in it.
So we're talking 4,000 to 20,000 parts per million in that case.
40,000, 40,000 to 200,000 parts per million.
Wow. Okay. So, I mean, an order of several magnitudes greater than where we're
That's
at
exactly
presently.
right. That's exactly right. So people are getting hot and bothered and get into a lather about a few parts per million increase in carbon dioxide. They really want to go and get a life because carbon dioxide is plant food. We have seen from satellite measurements over the last 40 years that the slight increase in carbon dioxide content in the atmosphere has greened the deserts. It's given us, together with GM crops and better fertilizers, it's given us greater food productivity. We're actually using less land now to feed people than we did 30, 40 years ago. So carbon dioxide is a wonder gas. It's a gas of life. And without plants, there would be no life on Earth. So we've got to be very grateful that we've got carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
So, I mean, really,
The more the merrier.
we're really in a CO2 famine at this point.
We are, and if we halve the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, we kill off all vegetation. So why would you naturally sequester carbon dioxide? Why would you have old oil wells and fill them up with carbon dioxide? What's the point of that?
It's madness.
We know that humans can live in a carbon dioxide rich atmosphere. Submariners will tell you that. If you walk into a room, a meeting room, then the carbon dioxide content in that room can be 2 or 3 times the carbon dioxide content of the air outside. It's not a poisonous gas. It's a gas of life for plants. So again, you cannot see it, you cannot smell it, you cannot taste it, and it's a perfect demon to frighten people with.
Yes. And of course, Professor William Happer is great with his portable CO2 meter that he packs into his lectures and pulls it out to display that fact. It's a good prop to
Well, yes,
illustrate that.
any lecture theatre, you do that. And when we go underground, we have a little machine that measures various gases underground. Carbon dioxide's one of them. Carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, dihydrogen sulfide, and oxygen. We measure at least in nitrogen oxides. We measure at least 6 gases underground, and a little meter that you can have in your pocket. And if an alarm goes off, time to get out. So we can measure this in real time now. And if you have a lecture theatre, even an air-conditioned lecture theatre, the carbon dioxide content increases quite significantly.
Yes, absolutely. So in this next section here, I've got some questions for you and sort of looking for short answers, yes or no, or a brief response. So is planet Earth experiencing a climate emergency?
No, definitely no. The greatest climate emergency we could have would be another ice age, where your country would be covered in ice, all of Europe would be covered in ice. A lot of Russia would be under ice. Definitely not.
Okay. Is there a consensus amongst climate scientists regarding climate change?
Yes, there is. And the word consensus isn't science. And therefore, that consensus and climate scientists are not practicing science. The consensus is that if we can keep frightening people about a climate emergency, then the research funds will keep flowing in. This has got nothing to do with climate. This has got nothing to do with the environment. It's about unemployable people keeping themselves employed with your taxes.
Well said. Is there any evidence to conclusively prove anthropogenic climate change?
That's a question I ask all the time. I've asked it to scientists, journalists, politicians, and the question is a simple one. Can you please show me that human emissions of carbon dioxide drive global warming? I have never been given an answer. To scientists, I ask them to give me half a dozen scientific papers that prove human emissions drive global warming. I have never received those papers. So in the absence of having any scientific evidence, the answer is there is nothing yet that has shown me that human emissions of carbon dioxide change climate. In the future, there may well be scientific papers that show this. But science has never settled. I don't close my mind.
Okay, excellent. And of course, 97% of the total CO2 emissions on Earth come from non-anthropogenic sources. And so we're expected to believe that this small fraction of anthropogenic emitted CO2 somehow alters the climate.
Well, this follows on from my statements just then. If humans emit 3% of the annual total of human emissions, and that drives climate change, then why doesn't the 97% drive climate change? No one has ever shown that the 97% of natural emissions, which is mainly degassing from the oceans, no one has ever shown that 97% doesn't drive climate change. So if you're going to have climate change from just 3%, you've got to have climate change from the other 97%. And so immediately, as the ancient Greeks would have told them 2,500 years ago, you've got that wrong. Your logic is flawed.
Yes, absolutely. So, of course, then reducing atmospheric CO2 is not going to save the present human civilization.
I think the human civilization can only be saved by a gene that gives people common sense.
Yeah. that should be engineered pretty quickly then.
I hope so.
And then what is your strongest disproof of the alarmist narrative of human-made global warming propaganda?
The disproof is the evidence that when we look over time at the emissions of carbon dioxide by humans, there is no relationship to carbon dioxide emissions and temperature. If we go back even further in time, there's no relationship to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and temperature. So there is no correlation, and you cannot argue correlation and causation, but there seems to be no evidence. But to make it even better, we've now had three great global experiments on human emissions. The first was World War II, the second was a global financial crisis, and the third was COVID. And in all cases, we changed the emissions of carbon dioxide by industry. In World War II, we started to emit far more carbon dioxide from industry, and yet we didn't have a warming. In fact, it was a cool period of time. In the global financial crisis, we had industry reduce its emissions. There was no cooling. In the COVID times, we've had industry have to reduce its emissions. And again, we see no cooling. But what we do see in the global financial crisis and in the COVID times is the rate of carbon dioxide increase has not changed. So if we've had emissions crank back and the rate of carbon dioxide emissions not change, that's telling us that the whole system is dominated by natural emissions of carbon dioxide. Now, we have some good evidence to show that. When we look at ice cores in the Arctic and Antarctic, we see that there's a perfect correlation between temperature increase and carbon dioxide increase. But when we look at it on a much tighter scale, we see that we have a natural temperature increase, and then 650 to 1600 years later, we get an increase in temperature. So it's actually temperature that drives carbon dioxide emissions and not the opposite. So if we look at that period of time, the 650 to 1600 years of lag, then the increase in carbon dioxide emissions coming from our oceans may well be due to the medieval warming. It may well be due to the Roman warming. We don't know. And that's the exciting part of science. We don't know.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And of course, the alarmists would like us to believe that we're presently going through an unprecedented temperature change in the history of Earth. Is this a correct statement?
That's absolutely totally incorrect. I suggest they go and look at the temperature increase we had at the end of the Younger Dryas about 11,000 years ago, where we had a 15 degrees Celsius rise in 10 years. That's global warming.
Yes. And then what poses a greater threat to humanity, global cooling or global warming?
We know from history, we know from medical research, we know from mythology that it's Jack Frost that kills you. It's the cold weather that takes out 90% of people in climate-related deaths. The other 10% is the warm weather. So we know, and we've known this for a very long period of time, and in my book, Green Murder, which came out in December 2021, I look at some of the medical research that's been done on this. And it's not that the medicos have looked at 27 people who've dropped dead. They've looked at 30 million deaths related to climate. And more than 90% of those deaths are due to cooling. This is people freezing. This is people not getting enough to eat. And on it goes. So absolutely and totally wrong, contrary to all the evidence, contrary to all the folklore we hear about Jack Frost, and contrary to what we know from logic.
Yes, yes. And then what about volcanism? Is this an important and overlooked component of climate change on Earth?
Yes and no. We have 1,517 volcanoes that we can see. These are the ones sticking above the ground. When they erupt, like the recent eruption in Tonga, they create spectacular footage. This spectacular footage from satellites and from the ground shows these great clouds of ash going into the air and tsunamis and crying babies and screaming mothers and drowning fathers. Oh, it's wonderful television. But that was a small eruption. And the second thing is that it didn't emit carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And pretty well all the volcanoes that we see sticking above the ground do not emit carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. They emit a lot of water vapor and a few other gases, sulfur gases, which are highly toxic. But carbon dioxide is a very minor component of those sort of volcanoes. But there's another type of volcano, and these are where we start to pull apart the planet. And these we get in the mid-ocean ridges, on fractures on the ocean floor. We get them above hotspots like Hawaii and the Galapagos Islands. And these volcanoes emit huge amounts of carbon dioxide. And we've checked that experimentally. We've made volcanic rocks in the laboratory. We've made the ones from these 1,517 volcanoes around the planet. And we can make those by cooking up rocks and trying to dissolve carbon dioxide in them. And we have the other sort of volcanic rock, a basalt, and we cook that up in the presence of carbon dioxide. And we can dissolve about 13.5% by weight carbon dioxide into that basalt. Now, these basalts are bringing carbon dioxide deep down in the earth up to the surface. That's the degassing process that has gone on for thousands of millions of years. Most of the emissions from volcanic carbon dioxide happen on the ocean floor. We don't see it, we don't measure it, and it doesn't bubble to the surface because it dissolves in the cold, saline, high pressure ocean floor waters, which later might upwell to the surface. And when that happens, you get a degassing of the oceans. So with the volcanoes we see, and we always read about this from our so-called climate scientists who don't really look at the breadth of the literature, they say, oh, we've measured very little carbon dioxide coming out of volcanoes. That's true for one sort of volcano. But the other sort of volcano, the most abundant volcanoes, and we've measured 3.4 million off-axis volcanoes on the ocean floor, they are the ones that release carbon dioxide. They are the rock chemistry where we can dissolve a lot of carbon dioxide into them. So I'm not arguing that the origin of the carbon dioxide emissions from the ocean are only from volcanoes, it's from other sources as well. But the original carbon dioxide, the original atmosphere of the planet, except for oxygen, all comes from volcanic activity. Ultimately, it just is recycled and recycled and recycled. And once you put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it lasts about 5 to 7 years before it's recycled into something else. The IPCC want it to last hundreds of years, and therefore they can give us our scare campaign models. But all the experimental and isotopic work shows that it's a very short residence time, and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere dissolves back in the oceans, And we had this constant cycling and recycling of components on Earth, be it rocks at depth or be it gases. We're always recycling on planet Earth. And carbon dioxide is just one of these components. And after we've recycled it, it might come out again as carbon dioxide hundreds of millions of years later into the atmosphere. So volcanoes above the ground don't put a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Those millions and millions and millions of volcanoes on the ocean floor put out a huge amount of carbon dioxide, but into the oceans.
And then what about the effect of the aerosols in terms of the ash that come out of the volcanoes? I'd imagine there's a tremendous volume that a large eruption would produce, and that has the effect of blocking the sun rays, which could have a compounding effect on the other processes within the planet.
Well, that's quite right. It's been well recorded, and these volcanoes that stick above the ground, when they explode, they put particles of ash into the atmosphere. This ash is actually tiny spicules of glassy material. Your lungs petrify. Your lungs can be cut such that you drown in your own blood in your lungs. The coral reefs and vegetation be covered in this ash and die. And that ash does a couple of laps of the planet, as does a sonic boom, and then eventually settles. That ash will remelt on turbines of jet aeroplanes. We had a case of a British Airways Boeing 747 that went through an ash cloud, and they lost all four engines, and they had to drop altitude, cool the turbines, fling off the bits of frozen, glassy ash that had and melted and formed on the turbines, and they restarted, I think, through the engines. I mean, those pilots must have had nerves of steel to do that.
Cool.
But we know about volcanic ash circulating the earth. Now, we've got minor eruptions like the recent one in Tonga. We've got some fairly big eruptions like, say, Krakatoa in 1883, and we've got super volcanoes like those in Washington State or Taupo in New Zealand or in Indonesia. And these super volcanoes put out anything from thousands of cubic meters of ash to tens of thousands of, sorry, cubic kilometers of ash to tens of thousands of cubic kilometers of ash. Krakatoa only put out 30 cubic kilometers of ash. Now, when you have a super volcano, you really fill the atmosphere with ash and you have recordable cooling periods for years to decades afterwards. We know that. There's a very, very interesting sequence of anthropological work that's been done on the Toba eruption about 70,000 years ago, where we had a super volcano. We had basically genocide happening between tribes who were stressed, and there was no food, and these tribes then moved. Some of them moved south into Australia, some of them moved north. We have very, very good evidence that we almost lost the human population 70,000 years ago. We probably went down to about 4,000 breeding pairs due to a volcano. Now, the Icelandic volcanoes also put out a lot of sulfur gases as an aerosol, and that's because seawater gets into the molten volcanic rock at depth. This also happened at Tonga recently, and these sulfur gases are highly toxic. And Benjamin Franklin recorded in the 1700s when he was in Paris about the unpronounceable Icelandic volcano that erupted and put out all these sulfur gases. Now people in Paris were coughing and dying of respiratory problems. So it's not only particles, it's gas. So we will get a slight cooling after a volcano, after a super volcano, we will get considerable cooling. But the planet then goes back to its normal trend, whether it was a cooling trend or warming trend. So one volcano can ruin your whole day, but it doesn't change the planet's climate forever.
Right. And then is the total solar irradiance an important component of Earth's climate?
Very much so. It varies enormously. We are approaching a period of low solar irradiance, and so we are entering a grand solar minimum. We've had a grand solar maximum. These are not considered at all in our climate models. So they view the sun as being static. They view the sun as having a constant amount of energy emitted. On a dynamic planet, in a dynamic solar system, nothing is static.
Yeah, that's just an oversimplification, and anybody that lives in the northern or southern hemisphere, sort of above 35 degrees latitude or below that, would understand that from the passing of the seasons. I mean, as the sun angle shifts, you go from summer to winter. So you and then of course then we have the other effects of the heliosphere and the cosmic rays entering the planet and so forth. So that's a oversimplification.
The cosmic rays are very interesting because they leave a fingerprint, a chemical fingerprint in sediments and in life way back in time. And we can see that there's been a varying amount of cosmic rays entering planet Earth. And we are protected by the sun's magnetic field and the Earth's magnetic field from cosmic rays. Now, the sun's magnetic field changes, as does the Earth's magnetic field, and at times you have a greater influx of cosmic rays. And so that is telling us that the sun is variable. And when we get a greater influx of cosmic rays, we have more clouds build up. These clouds reflect light and heat. These clouds lead to a little bit of cooling on planet Earth, maybe a considerable amount of cooling. Now, there was a wonderful study done years ago of someone looking at landscape painting by the European masters over a few hundred years and painting the landscapes, they would put in the clouds. And so this person measured the proportion of clouds in the sky at various times and then tied that in to the cosmic ray measurements that we have as a chemical footprint in older sediments. And bingo, was able to show that these landscape painters had recorded times when we knew that there was an influx of cosmic rays. And
Interesting.
so this is the integrated, interdisciplinary science that our climate scientists never even think about.
Yes. And you're talking, is that beryllium 26 that we're looking for as the cosmic ray marker?
That's one of them. That's one of them. Chlorine 36 is another. There are quite a few of these very short-lived isotopes where you add particles from the cosmic rays to them, and these atoms are a little bit too uncomfortable and they break down, and they break down over time. Carbon 14 is another one. The carbon 14 record has been destroyed since nuclear devices were first set off in the mid-1940s. But we have a number of them we can use. We can use iodine, which is the longest lived one. So there are quite a few of them around.
Okay, excellent. So let's shift gears here into determining who the winners and losers are of this climate alarmism. And I think that we could agree that the move towards renewable energy has been part of the transnational progressive technocratic sustainability movement for some decades now. So a couple of questions on the subject. Has there been any net environmental benefit in the move away from fossil fuel derived power, and towards these renewables?
No, it's been the opposite. The opposite because we have destroyed large amounts of farmland with solar panels. And these solar panels use a huge amount of energy to manufacture, mainly in China. And the amount of energy they produce is less than the energy that was used to make them. The second thing is the amount of carbon dioxide emitted in making these solar panels is less than the amount of carbon dioxide that is saved. And the third environmental problem is that they are not recyclable. They get dumped. And in those solar panels are all sorts of toxic chemicals like gallium and germanium and selenium and tellurium and arsenic, and these leach into the water table. That is certainly not environmentally friendly. It's not sensible to sterilize large amounts of farmland to put in solar panels. And it's not sensible to have solar panels in any area where there might be snowfall or heavy dust that affects their reliability. And it's not sensible to have a source of power that at maximum provides electricity for 8 hours a day. And with wind turbines, again, the same arguments apply. The amount of energy used to make a wind turbine is more than it will ever produce. The amount of carbon dioxide in making it that you emit is more than it will ever save. And the third thing is that the turbines have thousands of tons of concrete and steel as the base to hold this massive turbine, can be up to 200 meters high. And to hold that massive turbine, that is not rehabilitated. Any factory or any mining company has to rehabilitate the land after they've used it, but not the wind turbine companies. They leave this mess for the next generation. The turbines destroy scenery. and a slice and dice birds and bats. That could not be environmental to destroy the great raptors with the blades traveling at the tip of the blade. It's going about 300 kilometers of an hour. And then you've got another problem. These turbines are made mainly in China. So we are being held in the renewables industry captive to China. China is controlling the industry. And then you've got to dispose of these laminated blades, which have got epoxy resin, sometimes balsa wood, and you've got to chop down balsa trees in the rainforests of Brazil to create these, all sorts of metals and toxins, and some very toxic chemicals like bisphenol A. And what happens is these turbines get cut up and they get dumped, and the chemicals get leached into the water table. So you cannot possibly be an environmentalist and support having wind turbines and support having solar panels. This is not renewable energy, it's ruinable energy. It ruins the economy, it ruins the environment, it kills off real jobs, and it's run by elite groups who have persuaded governments to actually subsidize ruinable energy and to subsidize a form of energy that is totally and absolutely destructive of the environment. So you cannot be an environmentalist and support wind and solar turbines.
Yes. And of course, we, in terms of socioeconomic issues, we are outsourcing jobs, really to an enemy state. And, in the case of, the cobalt mining, we're utilizing, child slave labor in underground mines or open pit mines in Africa, which, I don't think a socially conscious, green leaning person has any interest in doing.
Well, it's worse than that. In many of these renewable energy generators and the facilities that come off it, like electric vehicles, we are stopping people in third world countries have cheap, reliable energy. So in India and in Africa, the energy to cook and keep warm comes from a fire inside a hut that's using twigs, using leaves, and that is burnt. That kills women and it kills children. We know there's a better way. It's coal-fired electricity, which is cheap and reliable. We know to get the nickel from any of these facilities. Most of the world's nickel now doesn't come from mines like you've got in, say, Sudbury, Ontario, which are sulfide nickel deposits. Most of the world's nickel deposits now are tropical soils. We mine the bases of tropical soil, and in many third world countries, we don't rehabilitate that. So to have nickel for your EV or for your solar panels, you are destroying tropical forests which are not being rehabilitated. And you mentioned the case of black child slave labourers in the underground mines in the Congo, where these kids are getting killed underground, where these kids are suffering cobalt poisoning, and they don't have the future. They don't have the life of someone who's got their mobile phone with 82 minerals in it and 61 elements from the periodic table. And they don't have the sort of life where someone with a mobile phone can send a like as a judgmental, moral comment. These kids have no future. They have no education. They get killed servicing those who want to moralise about the environment and about green policies. This is an appalling moral lapse that the Western world has.
Yes, absolutely. So, is this unfolding agenda, which is hurling humanity towards a renewable energy future, really a battle between a totalitarian globalist agenda and freedom-loving nationalists?
Well, that's a long and complex question. I think the renewable energy sector is underpinned by totalitarian governments. Such as China, the governments have been silly enough to be pressured by green environmental activists such that they want to go renewable, and that's created massive financial opportunities for people to come in there with wind and solar and to skin us alive. And then we see this wonderful own goal that Germany has kicked and England's done the same, and that is, well, for moral reasons, we're going to stop our coal-fired power stations. For moral reasons, we're going to close down our nuclear reactors. And we're going to use the wind and the sun. Well, Germany's a fairly high latitude country. There's not much sun there. You get these wonderful wind droughts, and Germany has suffered massive periods of no electricity. The electricity prices have gone through the roof. German industry is moving out of Germany and taking the jobs into other countries. And many people in Germany cannot afford to pay these high electricity bills. So they're going into the forests and foraging for timber so they can burn wood to keep warm and to cook. And to make it even worse, every time there's a energy drought in Germany, they suddenly want to turn on their coal-fired power stations and suddenly want to use gas. They don't have their own source of gas. It comes from Mr. Putin. And so they put themselves in a position where if they say, well, Mr. Putin, we don't like the cut of your cloth, he turns off the gas. He's done it before, he's done it to the Ukraine. He'll do it again to Europe. So Europe has put itself in this wonderful position where it once had cheap, reliable energy, which was why it was a great industrial part of the world. It now doesn't. It now is dependent upon a despotic leader, and it has plenty of energy itself. There's stacks of gas that you can have in Poland, in Germany, etc. But of course, they're so moral, they've stopped oil drilling and fracking. And so they have kicked the most wonderful own goal you can have. And older people on the pension now have a problem. They have a choice between having a hot shower, a hot meal, or a heated apartment or house. That is the end result of green politics, cozying up to people who want to skin the public alive because governments have created the legislative framework where someone can come in and get subsidies for solar and wind. They've created the legislative framework where Russia can now tighten the thumbscrews on Europe and the UK and especially Germany. And they created the environment where the cheapest, reliable energy and long-term energy that's non-polluting, and that is nuclear, is off the agenda. Now, fortunately, you in Canada have a great nuclear centre at Hamilton, Ontario. And you get a lot of your energy from there, a lot from hydro in Quebec. You've got multiple sources of energy, but when you go down to two sources of energy, wind and solar, you're dead. And that's what Europe's done.
Yes. Well, I understand the situation in Australia is not far behind. I mean, you're not really a cold country, but of course the houses are single pane window and most buildings aren't properly insulated. So when the temperature dips below 10 or 12 degrees, it becomes uncomfortable. And at your present electricity rates, people are having to make those same choices between, heating their homes, or I understand it's quite common to block off various parts of your home and heat one area, and then you heat the living room while you're enjoying an evening, and then you go to the bedroom and heat the bedroom and sort of play this game. I mean, that's
Well,
interesting.
that's exactly what we do. That's exactly what we do. And it doesn't get cold here in Adelaide. It doesn't get below zero. But there's no reason we should do that. We export 500 million tons a year of coal to Asia. We have huge coal deposits. They are incredibly clean coals, low ash, low sulfur, a bit like some of your coals that you've got in New Brunswick and also a little bit further to the east of there. You have very good quality coals. We do too. We export them. We're using less and less of it at home. And what's happening now is that we have in a coal mining province where the best coals in Australia come from, we have got wind power, which has failed. So what's happening is that that subsidised wind power is now going to have subsidised gas power to back it up. And these are going to be built adjacent to coal mines that produced thermal coal for coal-fired power stations, which we're closing down. This is absolute economic madness. So we are not far behind the madness of Europe. And the only solution I see is to have a massive economic stress, something like the Great Depression. And ultimately, then people will start looking at the fundamentals and look at costs. At this stage, we are so wealthy in the West, we can afford to be stupid. We are so wealthy in the West, we can waste money. We are so wealthy in the West, we can afford to moralize and keep third world people in their grinding poverty. And we do it.
Yes. So just wanted to unpack something you said. If Australia is exporting 500 million tons of coal, how much is being used domestically? What's the ratio there?
I can't remember the exact figure, but I would suspect it's probably less than 10 million tons a year we are using as thermal coal. And in two fairly small steel works that we have top quality coking coal, and some coking coal now is selling for more than twice the thermal coal price. This is wonderful quality coal. Australian coals are a little bit younger than your Canadian coals. We don't have the influence of ancient seawater, so they're low in sulfur. And so the pollution you get from Australian coals is wonderful. So it's a lot less. We don't have much ash, so we don't put particulate matter in the atmosphere. So in this country, we are an energy exporting country. We export 6,000 tons of uranium in yellowcake. We have one small medical research reactor, a 20 megawatt reactor. That's it. We an energy rich country. We're exporting huge amounts of energy, yet we have increasing costs of energy. The energy is becoming more unreliable, and we are now doing stupid things with energy such that the cost will continue to escalate. This is total, absolute madness that can only be solved, I think, by an economic crisis.
Would I be accurate to state that coal power was the single greatest factor for the Western world to lift its citizens out of poverty and create our modern affluent societies?
Yes, it was. It created the middle class. It lifted the UK, Europe, the US, everywhere out of poverty. And we're seeing exactly the same thing happen in China. And we cannot deny China using coal. We have used coal to become wealthy, and we cannot stop China doing this. And they are doing it. And they have had the greatest change in society that any country has ever had in the history of time, and that's due to coal. We should be worshipping coal, not demonizing it.
Yeah, and that's a great segue into the sort of final segment here of the global ramifications of all this. I understand that China accounts for about 50% of the global coal consumption annually, and as you suggest, you know, their economy has exploded, and hundreds of millions of people have been lifted out of an agrarian, impoverished condition, and they're generating about 60% of their domestic power presently from coal. So, you know, how is it that China is able to do this, and yet the rest of the nations of the world seem, or at least the Western nations, are turning a blind eye to this?
We are so wealthy, we can afford to moralize and do stupid things. China is not that wealthy. The second thing is, in Western countries, our parliaments are dominated by lawyers who don't solve problems but create problems, whereas the China bureaucracy is dominated by engineers and scientists.
That makes sense. That makes sense. And of course, the recently completed Hajoi Railway is an interesting example to highlight this dichotomy between the West and China, where they built this multi-billion dollar elevated railway to deliver some 200 million tons of coal from Inner Mongolia to its industrial heartland. What are your thoughts on that Hajoi Railway?
Well, I think it's absolutely wonderful feat of engineering. I think the Chinese are not cutting any corners. They are just going for everything. If you want the fastest train or the most use of steel or the biggest and best of this and that, it is now in China. And China will not be stopped. They want to get to the same standard of living that we have. They might not have the same quality of life that we have, but that'll come later. And as we've seen in history, every time you get a country have a rapid advance, they do it by having a lot of pollution. And once they have enough wealth, that wealth is used to clean up the pollution. That's what we've done in the West. That's what China is starting to do. And you see that in third world countries, the countries that are very poor have threats of extinction to their wildlife. And the countries that are wealthier are actually putting money into preserving the wildlife and stopping those extinctions. So the best thing that could ever happen to the world would be for China to become a very wealthy middle-class country. That would save the world's environment.
So really, the more coal they use, the better off the rest of us are.
Very much so.
And especially if we look at the science and the evidence that CO2 is not this villainous gas, that it is actually the gas of life, we can scrub those coal stack emissions of harmful pollution and get on with enjoying our lives.
Yes, that's very much so. And the whole technology in scrubbing out very ultra-fine particulate matter in smokestacks from thermal coal power stations has advanced enormously, especially with electrostatic precipitation. We can now have very clean, highly efficient, high-energy coal-fired power stations. China has got a lot of them, and they're building about one a week. We're destroying our coal-fired power stations.
And I understand the situation in Australia in terms of that, that the energy or the energy prices, because of the subsidized, unreliable energy going into the grid, which has to still be backed up with fossil fuels, is causing a real, is causing havoc to the energy grid in terms of the supply and the pricing.
Yes, that's exactly the case. It's also the case pretty well everywhere else in the world. We used to have high voltage coming out of the coal-fired power stations. These were close to the cities and close to the industrial hearts. Now we have solar and wind in remote areas, and we've got to basically build a new grid to have those sources of electricity put into the power grid. I have a real problem with this. Most of our greens are inner city greens. Why don't we have all of the wind turbines in inner city apartment blocks on top of them and in parks and along the beaches? These are the people who are wanting this. And of course, there's an economic reason for this, that you don't have to rebuild the grid and you don't have the voltage losses because the user is very close to where you generate the power. So if the Greens were not hypocritical, they would have all the foreshores and all the parks in cities with wind turbines.
And of course, the Paris Agreement seems to be a political tool for suppressing growth and instituting global governance over energy use and economic growth and the redistribution of wealth. What are your thoughts on the Paris Agreement?
Well, it is, except if you're China, India, or Russia, and then it's business as usual. So the Paris Agreement was, again, hitting wealthy Western countries and slowing down their economic growth. And I'm not saying that everyone in the West is wealthy. We have a lot of poor people in Western countries, but they are the ones who are going to suffer even more. So the whole Paris Agreement is a joke. It's a joke because the biggest emitters are not affected. It's business as usual. And why would you in China? Why would you in India? Why would you in Brazil or in Russia? Why would you stop your industrial growth when you're trying to pull your people out of poverty? This is just madness. And what we're doing is by instituting these Paris Accord measures, we are hitting our poor people. We are making the poor poorer. And again, I would argue, and I do in this book, Green Murder, I argue that green policies are inhuman. They are an attack on poor people.
And it would appear that the political left would like to see a return to pre-industrial revolution social hierarchy with the abolition of the middle class and the recreation of a new class of serfs. Do you believe that the World Economic Forum's Great Reset will come to pass? And what are your thoughts on this?
I think ultimately selfishness will stop people going that direction. But I don't want to go back to the past of, say, 500 years ago. We weren't living in nirvana. We weren't holding hands and singing and picking flowers. We had an average longevity of 28 years. The average longevity, 25 years. The average longevity now for the whole of the planet is 78 years. For you in Canada and others in Western countries, it's well into the 80s. I do not want to go back to the times of an average longevity of 25 years, where we died from a big bacterial blast. I don't want to be foraging and hunting and gathering. I don't want to be sitting at the entrance of my cave after the fifth consecutive day of heavy snowfall, where I can't find any vegetation to eat, where I can't find any animal to eat. This has got nothing to do with bringing us back 500 years ago. This is to control every single aspect of our life. We've seen some of that, those glimpses of it already. And I think ultimately the average person will say, no, I want to have my life. And the average person likes to have a meal, likes to have a comfortable bed, likes to have a family, likes to have a bit of sport, likes to have a vacation. And they don't want that destroyed. And so ultimately, I think common sense is going to rule on this. But these despots are now the elites who are pushing us in that direction. I don't think they'll succeed. I certainly hope they won't succeed. And I hope for the future of my grandchildren that they don't, because I'll be dead then.
Yes, yes. So how have we arrived at this conjuncture, and what can we do to turn this around?
We've had a 40-year dumbing down of our education system. It's been targeted by the left. It's been targeted deliberately to destroy thinking processes, to destroy history, to destroy the creation of critical and analytical abilities, and the chickens have come home. We are now in a situation where our education systems in the Western world are appalling, where young people do not know what knowledge is. They have access to information, but they cannot critically evaluate whether that information is valid or not. This has been the long road. It's been a long path. It's been a deliberate path of the crazy left to completely change our society. We now are in a situation where we have to have a crisis, and without the educated people to help to solve the crisis, such as engineers or Air Force pilots or whatever, we are not going to be able to get out of the trouble. And so we're going to, again, have to have a big reset and bring our education systems back to teaching the basics. And the basics are being able to read, being able to write, being able to compute in your head, having a knowledge of history, having a knowledge of languages and mathematics and science. We don't have that any longer. We have opinions that are given to children at school. And I saw them in my university teaching years. People would come into first year classes and they would know everything. And by asking a couple of very simple questions, they would realize they knew nothing. And I think they had a good reason to be angry about what they'd been fed over the years. And the problem is that we have many of our teachers now who have come through that system. So we're now into another generation of people who have had the dumbed down education system. And the education system, I think, is the heart to prosperity. And we realized this in the Industrial Revolution, when many industrial towns had their mechanics institutes and literary institutes, where people who might have worked in the cotton mills during the day went at night time to learn something fundamental, to learn engineering or to learn mathematics or to learn literature. And they realized in the Industrial Revolution that the only way out of poverty was to have an education. And going back to the very start of this program, that's what my mother realized. We were poor. My father was an invalid. She realized that the only way we three children could get out of that cycle of poverty was to get a university education. And we did, and we escaped poverty. Mm-hmm. And so we are heading down that path of poverty because of a lack of education that is meaningful.
Yeah, very compelling, very compelling. So this move towards renewables and this larger left agenda has obviously been based upon poor policies and opinions, and then compounded by a political class that lacks the intestinal fortitude to face their failures and implement better policies in the face of growing evidence. Would you agree with that?
Oh, very much so. You can count on a sawmiller's hand the number of good politicians in the Western world. I can think of only one, Viktor Orban in Hungary, and that's about it. I cannot think of a true leader in the Western world. We don't have them. They're gone. And we really do need them.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I would argue that Governor DeSantis in Florida is doing a pretty good job. There's a few leaders in America. But yes, I mean, in Canada, that's an absolutely accurate statement. Where the leadership and the political class is actually in this administration is probably the most unqualified group of individuals to ever lead a country.
Well, you could be talking about my country also. It is sad.
Oh, boy. So how do we convey the scientific facts of climate realism to skeptics and, more importantly, to the younger generations? How do we get this into their minds and deprogram them from what the indoctrination system has taught them?
I used to try to present data or evidence, and it just hasn't worked. And so now my approach is to ask a simple question. So if someone makes a statement, say, oh, that's interesting. Can you please show me? Where can I find this information? Give me, say, half a dozen scientific references so I can read them, because I'm really quite interested in what you said. And this goes back to a question we raised earlier. Can you please show me that the human emissions of carbon dioxide drive global warming? Or in the case of a scientist, can you please give me half a dozen scientific papers that prove that human emissions of carbon dioxide drive global warming? Now, they can't. And that makes them feel very uncomfortable. And that's the best you can do, is to put people in a position where they have to change their mind. Now, I've had to do it throughout my scientific career. I've made my name on one particular area of science, and 20 years or so ago, I started to question it and started to go back and look at, I looked at about 115 kilometres of diamond drill core, and I realised, wait a minute, I'm wrong. I've got this wrong. And so rather than having someone publish in a gentle way and criticise me, I published a paper criticising all of my work, and I wasn't too gentle with myself, just saying, look, I was wrong because I've got new data. And so I think the best thing you can do is to make someone feel uncomfortable and to make them feel that their beliefs are probably not valid, and hopefully leave it up to them to say, maybe I've got that wrong. And if they do show signs of being uncomfortable, you can really come in and sink the slipper and say, well, using the same thinking processes, have you got any financial decisions wrong? Have you got personal decisions wrong? You really have to go back and reevaluate why you hold an opinion. And as I said earlier, I don't have opinions. I have facts. And if the facts change, then my conclusions will change.
Yeah, interesting. And this, of course, is a very important aspect of what we're trying to do here, which is convey this these facts and this evidence to the younger generation and to the people who have been duped by the mainstream narrative. Otherwise, all of our work is kind of somewhat in vain. I mean, we have to be able to bring more minds over to our side.
Yes. Well, I think people become irrational for a large number of reasons. And I think I used to think that being rational was a human state. I now think being irrational is human, with the occasional bout of rationality. And so once you've come into one of these fads and fashions, to persuade someone that they're wrong is very hard to do. And one by one, they will change their mind. But that's going to take time. Very quickly, they came into this climate hysteria, which was the fashion. But one by one, they are changing their mind. And I'm actually quite surprised the number of people now that tell me that, well, you know, I think it's a load of rubbish. People who I wouldn't have thought would have held that view. So I'm fairly confident that it will take time for people to come to the conclusion that it was wrong. But it's very, very hard as a human to admit that you were wrong. And this is a human characteristic that we're up against.
Yes, yes. So, Professor Plummer, what research areas are you presently pursuing or plan to pursue here?
Well, I have been working on the world's biggest lead zinc silver ore body since February 1968. I have made my scientific name working on this greatest accumulation of metal, and of course all the obvious reasons as to why it happens. And it happened due to a lot of carbon dioxide being around, actually. And so I've published many scientific papers on this, but there was once a compilation of everything we knew about Broken Hill in 1923. There was another one in 1950, and I'm going to do the next one to put down everything I know about this massive accumulation of metal. And one of the reasons I got interested in carbon dioxide is that there's a huge amount of carbon dioxide in this mass of metal. And that is an integral part in the chemical processes to form it. And this carbon dioxide came from deep down, but also interacted with the atmosphere on a Tuesday 1,685 million years ago. So that's my next venture. I've just finished a venture which took me a couple of years, and that was a book called Green Murder. And I wrote that while I was being treated for a melanoma that got into the brain and into the lungs and all my internal organs. And you can sit around and moan and groan, or with a cannula in your arm, you can write a book. Well, I decided to write a book. And so that latest book is a result of having a couple of years of cancer treatment and surviving. And so my next venture is to put down what I've been working on life. I'm constantly writing short stories and small newspaper articles. I was just submitted an article yesterday to The Spectator, which I published this week, on climate change on the planets outside our solar system. We've actually got evidence that climate change happens on exoplanets and planetesimals way outside our solar system. Now, I just think that's fabulous. So I'm constantly writing things. I'm constantly working on these major projects, but I'm also full-time employed. I'm working with Mrs. Gina Reinhart and her Hancock Prospecting Group companies, and I'm a director of a number of her companies, run all of her South American operations. And so for someone at my age, I'm 75, I should be sitting back retired. I am working harder and longer than I ever have in my life, and I'm not complaining.
Good on you, mate. And so where would listeners be able to purchase your new book, The Green Murder?
Call up greenmurder.com, and that will direct you to the sites. It is printed in the US, and so even though your postal and transport problems are excessive, it can be delivered fairly quickly from the US to Canada. It's also printed in the UK, and it's printed in Australia. And in December, I went to the publisher's office, and I sat down and signed and inscribed 6.5 tons of this book. I don't measure books in the numbers. I measure them in the tonnage. And so if you buy it through the publisher, which you can get through that site, greenmurder.com, then there's a very good chance that I will sit down again and sign a few tons of books.
All right, fantastic. Well, I'll do that myself. That would be great to have a signed edition from you. Well, sir, you know, this has been an outstanding conversation. I've been meaning to get you on the show for some time now, and I'm happy that I have you have finally got you on. You're a wealth of information and logic and reason. So I appreciate your time, and I look forward to reading that book, and I suggest the listeners do the same.
Thank you for having me.
Very good, and enjoy your upcoming rally in your vintage Volvo. That's going to be a great time.
I certainly will. I might not live after that, but I'll die in a ball of flame with a smile on the face.
There we go, sir. Fantastic. Well, you have yourself a great day, and I appreciate your spending time with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye.